I'm going to start the bidding here. $57 million, $58 million now, $58 million, $59 million now, $65 million on the telephone now.
One night in May 2017, Sotheby's hosted an auction. For sale, an untitled 1982 painting by the late New York artist Jean-Michel Basquiat. The painting is abstract, with blue, red, and yellow. There's a black skull in the middle. Our colleague Kelly Crowe was in the room. Basquiat's paintings have sold for millions before, but she expected this auction to be his biggest.
I knew it was poised to be a biggie because it was guaranteed to sell for at least $60 million, which, again, was sort of already going to be a record-breaking moment for this artist. And then when the bids actually started filing through, there were at least four people who wanted it for that much. And so just the bids just kept climbing and climbing.
Sell it. Fair warning now. Is that a bid, sir? $69 million now. New bidder, $78 million now. $79 million.
And I think that's when the whole sale room sort of pulled out their cell phone cameras and started gasping.
Soon, the price rose to $80 million, then north of $90 million.
The hammer is up, sir. I'm selling on this side of the room. It's Yuki's bid, a fair warning. And selling, thank you, sir, for $98 million. Thank you, Yuki. Congratulations. Thank you very much.
The final price tag, after fees, $110.5 million. Basquiat had dethroned Andy Warhol as the highest-valued American painter ever.
It was, you know, the most expensive painting by an American artist, most expensive painting by a Black artist, the most ever paid for work painted after 1980. I mean, records fell like dominoes that day. I'll never forget it.
Basquiat died in 1988. And since his death, his popularity has only grown. His paintings continue to sell for tens of millions of dollars at auction. And licensing deals with major brands like Coach, The Gap, and Converse have broadened his reach. You can buy a Basquiat iPhone case or even sniff a Basquiat candle. But none of that merchandise can get sold without the approval from two people, his younger sisters. For the past 9 years, they've controlled the keys to the Basquiat kingdom. And they're redefining what it means to run an artist's estate. Here's one of his sisters, Lisanne Basquiat.
I think part of the role is to ensure that other people honor him, you know, and to point people to the direction of looking at his work, you know, and having his back as a family. And so that's kind of an interesting place to be.
Welcome to The Journal, our show about money, business, and power. I'm Ryan Knutson. It's Friday, April 8th. Coming up on the show, a conversation with the Basquiat sisters on how they're managing one of the hottest brands in art.
It can be hard to see the challenges the people we work with are facing. Addressing these invisible struggles can make us and our companies healthier. Join Holly Robinson-Pete on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare.
Jean-Michel Basquiat grew up in Brooklyn. He's the son of a Haitian father and a mother of Puerto Rican descent. He was the oldest of three kids. Last week, Kelly interviewed Basquiat's two younger sisters, Lisanne.
Hi, my name is Lisanne Basquiat. I am Jean-Michel Basquiat's sister, and I'm the middle child.
And Janine.
Hi, I am Janine Herovo, and I am Jean-Michel's youngest sister.
Janine and Lisanne's brother is now one of the most famous artists of the 20th century. But as a kid, he was just their playful and creative big brother.
You know, he would have very elaborate things that he would do back in the day when ventriloquist dolls were a big deal. He had this ventriloquist doll, and he would put it at the top of the stairs and create this really elaborate scene with, like, you know, curtains and, you know, a candle and the light shining just so eerily on the face of this thing, and turn off all the lights so that the people coming up the stairs would be, you know, frightened.
You were his first audience. He was performing for you first. I love that.
Yes. All the time. All the time. Mm-hmm.
Or guinea pigs.
Or guinea pigs. Yeah.
His mom would bring him to art galleries as a kid. And as he developed his own interest in art, he decided to make the streets his canvas. He and a friend started to paint graffiti around New York, signing it under the name Samo. Here's Kelly again.
In the late 70s, he was sort of palling around with another artist named Al Diaz in the Lower East Side, and they kind of created this character called Samo, and they were sort of writing these maybe kind of poems, epigrams, sort of just scrawling them on the side of buildings.
Basquiat's art was often poems or cryptic messages graffitied on subway walls or under bridges. And it would say things like, Samo for the so-called avant-garde, or Samo for those of us who merely tolerate civilization. And his eye-catching graffiti started to get noticed. Here's some of his admirers in a 2010 documentary talking about this mysterious new street artist.
I started to see these oblique pieces of poetry around the city. A pin drops like a pungent odor. Copyright Samo, or make soup, build a fort, set that on fire.
Before long, he started getting attention from journalists in the New York art scene.
And it just felt very fresh and new. It was neo-expressionist, which was kind of the vibe of the art world at the time. Kind of, he didn't look like all the other artists, and he moved through the art world with such kind of grace and style that everyone was smitten.
One of his fans was a big name, Andy Warhol. Warhol loved Basquiat's early work and took him on as a protege. And Basquiat started dating someone, a singer who just recorded her first single. He brought her to Thanksgiving one year. Here's his sister, Janine.
And, you know, he said, oh, this is Madonna. And so I said, who's that? And then he mentioned the song, you know, which we had heard. And we said, oh, yeah. And literally, I think she became, you know, big. You would hear her record after that, you know, maybe 2 or 3 weeks after that. But yeah, only met her one time, but it was definitely memorable.
Our colleague Kelly says Basquiat experienced an explosion in popularity and output after an art dealer gave him studio space.
And what resulted was just this gorgeous profusion of wit and intellect and street smarts and just real aesthetic beauty in describing the city and the culture that he came from and what it felt to be sort of young and Black in New York, you know, in the 80s. It really just took over the art world by storm. You know, he was the youngest artist ever to exhibit in the Whitney Biennial. He was only 22 at the time.
Here's Basquiat in an interview from 1985.
I never went to an art school. I failed the art courses that I did take in school. I just looked at a lot of things. And that's what I think I learned about art by looking at it.
Even though he didn't have formal training, his sister Janine told Kelly that her brother had big ambitions after he left home.
He always said, when I come back home, I'm going to come home in a limousine and, you know, let my father know that I've made it.
Janine remembers one day when her brother was in his 20s, he followed through on that promise.
It was early in the morning, 7 o'clock in the morning. I was getting dressed to go to school. My dad and stepmom were getting dressed to go to work. And the doorbell rings. We go down to answer the door, and it's Gemma Show. And, you know, he left a teenager and he came back a man. He was in a 3-piece suit. His hair was this beautiful mane of dreadlocks. And he had been partying all night because he had a great, night of selling his works. And literally he, you know, came to the door and said, Papa, I've made it. And it was a beautiful moment. I was really, really proud of him because he decided that that's what he wanted to do and he did it.
Then A few years after bursting onto the art scene, Basquiat was found dead in his East Village apartment.
We lost him to a heroin overdose in 1988. He was only 27 at that time. So dying young, dying early, being considered a genius, being from sort of a marginalized group or that was, you know, historically overlooked by the powerful classes, all of that kind of stew has just kind of resulted in an artist who today is just endlessly fascinating and haunting, right, for an art world that has since become very global. And, you know, today he's a pop culture phenomenon.
His fame continued to grow even after he died. Hollywood made a biopic in 1996. His art fetched higher and higher prices, and younger generations fell in love with his work. His father, Gerard, closely protected the estate with his stepmother until he died in 2013. The family holds an undisclosed number of pieces that the public has never seen. That is, until this week. That's after the break.
This episode is brought to you by C3 AI. Insights. You need them to solve business problems, but buried in volumes of disparate data, they're seemingly invisible. C3 Generative AI enables business leaders to instantly access secure, hallucination-free, verifiable insights from a unified knowledge source, all with a natural language search. Turn the invisible into the obvious with C3 Generative AI. Learn more at c3.ai.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/journal. Terms and conditions apply.
When Basquiat's father, Gerard, died in 2013, his sisters took over the estate. Before that, they had led pretty private lives. Lisan worked as a corporate executive, and Jeanine, the youngest sister, worked as an accountant and raised a family. Now, alongside their stepmother, they're running the multi-million-dollar estate of the most expensive American painter who ever lived. Our colleague Kelly Crow asked the sisters what that's like.
What do you see as your responsibility in terms of managing the estate and taking care of it?
I think the biggest responsibility is trying to leave the mark of someone that you love without their input and making decisions and doing things in a manner that you feel will honor their legacy and give them the integrity that they deserve and that you believe you are doing for them. I think that's the hardest part for both of us.
I never expected that one of us would pass away and that the other two would be doing this work of, you know, taking care of them and continuing to care for them, you know, after passing away. So I think losing a sibling is tough.
For his sisters, managing the estate is part family obligation and part corporate enterprise. Kelly says family estates have traditionally played a smaller role in the art community.
The thing is, they're usually seen as kind of gatekeepers and historically, right? Arbiters of what was real or not, right? Like they used to authenticate works and they were kind of seen as like the guard dogs, right? At the gate snarling at the market for trying to, you know, push fake this or fake that. Typically, they've always been pretty private.
But Jeanine and Lisan have changed that model, seeing themselves more as curators and guides to Basquiat's work. They want to make his art more accessible to the public.
I think the sisters realize, right, that their brother is one of the most popular and intriguing artists around, and they kind of hold the keys to the kingdom, right? They knew him better than most people. They have access to works and notebooks and childhood photos and basically to the story, right?
To do this, Jeanine and Lisan work with an agent named David Stark, who specializes in licensing art.
You know, we kind of sit down and kind of go through whether or not we feel they are appropriate or not. And the licensing has really skyrocketed over the years because of Jean-Michel's relevance.
Is there any particular product sort of broadly that you guys ixnayed right off the bat? Like, I don't know, like Rice Krispies cereal in Japan or something with Basquiat on it. I don't know. Anything fun that you guys vetoed?
No. You know, it's funny. I think one of the things, you know, and I didn't always feel comfortable saying, you know, that this was the role that we were in. And a lot of it was because we were new to it and figuring it out. And, you know, we're really private people. But what I used to say was that when people would ask what I did for a living, I would say, oh, I'm in brand management, right? And so our role is to ensure that whatever's happening is paying homage to Jean-Michel, you know, that we're respecting his work and that we're also making his work accessible for people who might not otherwise be able to afford a painting or a drawing.
Since they've taken over, the sisters and Stark have licensed Basquiat a lot. There's everything from Basquiat Uno cards to Gap t-shirts and even Basquiat skis. All this branded gear does two things. It boosts his name recognition even further, and it gives fans a chance to show off their love. Here's our colleague Kelly again.
You know, you're aligning yourself with the values and the credibility of that artist too, right? You're telling the world, this guy is cool, and I have his, you know, skateboard, so I'm cool. And when you get that, then you get the, you know, you get the Basquiat socks, you get the Basquiat skis, you get, you know, an estate that's licensing sort of products galore at much lower price levels. And when you can go into your museum gift shop and buy a Basquiat book or Basquiat socks or Basquiat whatever, like you feel like you're kind of buying into that dream, that aspiration that only billionaires can really afford the real thing, but you can have this little thing.
And now Basquiat, a 1980s neo-expressionist painter, is seen as such a marketable brand that a major jewelry company wanted to tap into it. Last year, Tiffany & Co. released an ad campaign starring Jay-Z and Beyoncé. In the ads, Jay-Z's hair is styled like Basquiat's signature dreadlocks. And the Basquiat painting Equals Pi can be seen in the background. Some in Basquiat's old art community didn't love the fact that his graffiti-style street art was being used to hawk diamonds and other expensive jewelry. But the sisters told Kelly that they thought the campaign was great. And as Basquiat has become more mainstream, his paintings have become even more expensive. When that Basquiat painting sold for $110 million in 2017, it put him into the so-called $100 million club, which includes big names like Picasso, Warhol, Cezanne, and Da Vinci.
You know, really only at that point, only 10 other pictures on the planet had ever crossed that mark. I mean, it really put Basquiat sort of in a whole different league.
But his sisters haven't said yes to everything. Last year, the estate stopped an auction of a Basquiat NFT, citing the seller's lack of rights to the work. Now, Kelly says the sisters are taking another big step. They're opening the vault and curating a show in New York. It'll include family photos, notebooks, and paintings that most people have never seen.
They said, you know, so we started going through the estate and looking through everything that their father had sort of carefully looked after all these years. They just realized how little of it had been seen. And they thought, you know, it almost felt unfair when people were paying millions of dollars for, you know, to rebuy pictures that had come up for market a few years ago. Like when they're sitting on this real trove of unseen works and never exhibited works.
The exhibition in Manhattan is called King Pleasure, named after one of Basquiat's paintings. The sisters wanted to demythologize their brother. They've added family touches, like recreating Basquiat's Borum Hill bedroom and his art studio that was on Great Jones Street.
What was the sort of the germinating moment? Where does the beginnings of the show start for you?
That actually started back in 2017. We had already kind of been doing this for a number of years and, you know, started thinking about what's the next thing that we can put our hands into. And we started thinking about how we have works that have been sitting in the warehouse for 30 years that haven't been seen. They should be seen, and his fans should see them.
The sisters didn't move forward at first, but after the upheaval of the past few years, they decided to revisit the idea.
When the world was shut down and so many things were happening with George Floyd and, you know, the pandemic. We felt like that was a good time to pick this back up and get going. And that was, you know, almost 2 years ago, and we haven't looked back since.
Tickets for the show are running about $35 a pop. What's in it for the sisters? Are they making money off the show?
I mean, the estate will make money from tickets. They're charging tickets, which I'm sure will probably offset some of the installation costs and just the venue rental costs. So the tickets, you know, are something that they make, and the merchandise that they make in the store. That's a better way for perhaps an estate to sort of raise funds rather than having to sell off the pieces, right? Like if you can make enough by selling merchandise and tickets, and you don't really ever have to sell the work to keep the lights on.
And with valuations as high as they are now for Basquiat's, a showcase of the unseen works could give the art world a taste of the private collection. It could also help gauge the collection's worth. Kelly asked the sisters about that.
I'm sure that art dealers and auction houses have been salivating over this, though. Like, what are your long-term plans for the material? Are you holding the wolves at bay? Or are you thinking about donating it or giving it or just returning to the estate? How are you handling that?
It's returning to the estate. This is not a commercial project at all. This is a response to the incredible adoration, you know, for people just really wanting more of Jean-Michel and to gain more insight into Jean-Michel. And we wanted to show people who appreciate his work more of his work and to give him a perspective that they can't get anywhere else. This is a story that only we can tell. This is also a gift. This is in response to the incredible appreciation that so many people have had for Jean-Michel and for his work. And it's also our gift to our family.
Kelly and other Basquiat fans are excited about that gift and to finally glimpse the unseen works from one of the biggest artists in American history.
I feel like I'm standing in front of a pyramid, right? Hoping to crack open a door to like a secret vault, if you will. The Jean-Michel Basquiat estate has been one of those warehouses that I've always longed to snoop around in, frankly. And it's just not really been possible to do that. So that's why I think, I mean, just the chance to see nearly 200 Basquiats that you haven't seen is going to be mind-blowingly fun for folks who can get there.
That's all for today, Friday, April 8th. A quick disclosure before we go. One of the sponsors of the new Basquiat exhibit is Spotify, the parent company of Gimlet. And as you know, The Journal is a co-production of Gimlet and The Wall Street Journal. Your hosts are Kate Linebaugh and me, Ryan Knudsen. The show's produced by Annie Baxter, Catherine Brewer, Shia LaDuff, Pia Gadkari, Rachel Humphreys, Brendan Klinkenberg, Matt Kwong, Annie Minoff, Laura Morris, Afif Nasuli, Enrique Perez de la Rosa, Sarah Platt, Aaron Randall, Alan Rodriguez Espinosa, Mark Sovel, and Catherine Whalen. Our engineers are Griffin Tanner and Nathan Singapak. Our theme music is by So Wiley. Additional music this week by Blue Dot Sessions, Peter Leonard, Bobby Lord, Emma Munger, and So Wiley. Fact-checking by Nicole Pasolka. Thanks for listening. See you Monday.